Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the April 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. With me this month are Phil Broadwith, Mike Brown and Eleanor Richards, and they're here to talk about how a modified CD can be used to count blood cells, a way to run your iPod on fizzy drinks, and how adding water can make some fluids thicker, which turns out to be ideal for the diet industry.
If you think about wanting to diet, you still want to eat the same amount of food and feel full, so you want food that will fill your stomach but not necessarily have the same calorific or fat content, so you get the same kind of fullness and pleasure from eating it but without the pain on the other side.
So why sell food when you can sell water? Sounds ideal for supermarket own brand products, doesn't it? I'm Chris Smith, and this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And with a hop, a skip and a jump, we're off with the first story. Mike.
Okay, Chris. Jerian Huskins and his colleagues at the University of Twente in the Netherlands and his collaborators at the University of Cork in Ireland have been looking at how molecules, dye molecules, move across a surface.
So how do they do it? What are they looking at?
They've taken dye molecules with two legs and they've got a surface, a monolayer surface of beta-cyclodextrin, which is a ring-type structure, and they've put them onto the surface, rather like you'd see tyres in an obstacle course where you have to put your legs into each of the tyres as you walk down the obstacle course. And what they've done is they've positioned the molecules at one end and they've seen, depending on the concentration of competing cyclodextrins, so free cyclodextrins in the solution around them, they've seen how the molecules move across the surface, and they found that there are three mechanisms for this.
So do those competing molecules effectively stand in the tyres as well, so they stop the molecule that you want to walk getting its feet into those holes? Is that how it works?
They compete for the feet of the molecules, and then other molecules, other dye molecules, also fit in the monolayer holes as well. So you've got competing from other dye molecules on the surface and competing from the cyclodextrins holding onto the feet in free solution.
And how do they watch the walking?
They use fluorescent microscopy to see what's going on in the solution. So what they've found is that if you've got a high concentration of competitor molecules, so you've got a high concentration of cyclodextrins floating around in solution, and also dye molecules on the surface locked in, then the molecules actually lift off the surface, float through the surface, and then plant themselves somewhere else. So they're actually flying through the solution. In contrast, when there's a low concentration of competitor molecules, the molecules pick up one leg, move to the next one next to them, and so they walk across the surface.
But why do they make these movements at all?
They're actually moving spontaneously. They've got weak interactions between the surface and the legs, and they spontaneously move one leg at a time. It depends on if both legs happen to move at the same time, then they'll float through solution as well.
And the third way?
The third way is when you've got a medium amount of competitor species, so a medium amount of the cyclodextrins, one of the feet on the molecule would detach from the surface and actually lock into one of the free cyclodextrins, and the other foot will actually move along the surface, so you actually hop along the surface. So you've got one mechanism where you're walking, one where you're hopping, and one where you're jumping and flying through the solution.
All very elegant, but why is this helpful? What does this teach us?
Okay, so the research team wanted to look at how molecules move across a surface and bind, because they're looking at a bigger picture of how bacteria and viruses bind to cell membranes. Depending on the concentration of the viruses or the bacteria at the cell membrane, they're actually seeing how possibly these interact and how, you know, diseases take over cells and things like that.
So you could say research to die for. Thank you, Mike. Eleanor, tell us about this one. This is fantastic. So you've heard of self-help books and CDs. Now you're telling me that you can diagnose yourself with a CD.
Yes, that's right. A team of researchers in the US, led by Gang Lo Gun Liu, I've integrated a microfluidic device on top of just a plain normal digital compact disc, and the device is there to analyse cells. And you can insert the disc into just plain old standard computer disc drive for analysis, and this could be used to diagnose diseases.
So let me get this straight. They take a CD, or what would be a normal CD, and instead of the sort of the laser track inside, they have replaced this with a microfluidic device, which you can put something into that track.
Yes, that's right. What they've done is they've burned a data file onto the CD consisting of a sequence of binary numbers. And then on top of that, they've added the microfluidic layer with channels, and then they inject their fluid samples into these channels, and then they pop it into the computer.
This is for real, not an April Fool.
It's not, no.
And
it's for real.
So you put it into the CD drive, and the laser, which would scan the data track, then also goes through the microfluidic device and hits the cells that are going to be in there.
It does, yes. So as the laser's reading the binary data, it produces a graph or a readout. And then when it hits the cells, it interrupts the readout. So you get this reading on the graph so you can tell where the cells are.
Oh, so you effectively get a breakdown in the data. And so it knows that where it's not reading data, that must be a cell.
Yes, yes.
So it can count the cells.
Yes, yeah.
And also size them.
It can, yes.
Blimey. So does this actually work? What can you do with it? What sorts of cells?
It does blood cell counting and sizing. And
so what do they say you could do with it? You do sort of diagnosis at home with your own PC then?
Just using it at home for personalised medicine, really. So you can put your own sample into it, pop it in the PC and then let the doctor know the results.
Fantastic. That's got to be one of the best stories I've ever heard. And of course, presumably then, any CD player will read this. It's the disc that's the special thing. So that's what they're going to market.
Yes.
And that CD comes with a bonus musical track too, we're told, by Soft Cell. No, I'm just kidding. That really is an April Fool. Thanks, Eleanor. But speaking of microfluidic devices, University of Virginia scientist James Landers has found a way to bring the molecular biology laboratory down to the size of something you can hold in your hand.
So the applications are really numerous. At the outset of microfluidics in the early 1990s, we're really focused on clinical. The idea that you could now, through reducing the volumes of reagents needed, the volume of sample needed, drastically reduce turnaround time on clinical assays. And so the initial goal was bring this into the clinical world where you can now take the 2 or 3 day assay that is done in the clinical lab that looks at a molecular defect in DNA or in proteins and now do that in an hour, which brought you into the realm of potentially point of care testing, where now rather than sending a sample off to a central testing lab, you could now do that in the doctor's office. And this dramatically changes how physicians would practice. Rather than having somebody come back a week later for a result, you talk about the patient waiting out in the waiting room and coming back in 45 minutes and talking about the result from the test. There's also been a massive growth in interest in applying this to forensics, primarily for the application to forensic DNA testing. Their turnaround time is critical. You can only hold somebody for so long. If it takes 10 hours to get a result and you can only hold them for a period of time that is substantially shorter than that, that's a problem. There's also the cost of holding people.
And also, I guess, there's the whole question of chain of evidence, because in the lab in which I work, we occasionally do handle specimens which are from crime scenes, and we have to have senior people continuously scrutinising and shepherding a single sample through the laboratory in multiple different steps, which takes up a senior person's time for a whole day or even longer. If you can do the whole thing on one analytical platform, one chip, or one microfluidic device where only one person has to put that in a machine and the whole thing gets done, A, quickly, and B, in one go, no transfer. That's got to be better from a forensic point of view, too.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Chris, and it's a great point for two reasons. The first one is the chain of custody issue becomes a non-issue primarily because it's a closed system. Once the sample goes in, there's no opportunity for essentially intra-step or inter-step loss of chain of custody or mixing up of samples. The second one is an issue of contamination, and there's two different spins on this. The issue of contamination from a forensic point of view is once the sample's in the closed system of the microfluidic device, you minimize, if not completely obliterate, any opportunity to contaminate any part of that process with exogenous DNA, which from a defense point of view, you know, defending this in court, is critical. If you flip that to the clinical side, it's actually a different reason that you want to have a contamination-free type of system. And that is, if you now have patient blood, potentially from patients who are infected with various infectious agents, you now want to minimize the exposure of the lab technician to what's in the chip. And so you minimize contamination for those two applications in very important ways.
Well, I'm sold on that. So tell us about the technology, though. How did you manage to do this? What were the big obstacles you had to surmount to deliver this platform?
The platform is still under development with a collaboration between the University of Virginia, Zygen Microlab, and Lockheed Martin. And we're building and testing a beta unit right now. And the challenges are, number one, building three instruments into one and making sure it's not the size of a mini Austin. The other is, when you're dealing with 25 microliters of a PCR master mix, the volume to surface area ratio is very large. When you shrink down now that volume into a half a microliter or less, the surface area to volume ratio has essentially been elevated, sometimes order of magnitude. And now the issues associated with components, critical components in that very small volume sticking to the wall and essentially being deactivated or lost becomes very critical. And PCR simply does not go. The other types of issues that you deal with is the fact that you now have to keep different chemistries divided when needed, but intimately fluidically connected when you want. So, for example, if you do just conventional solid phase extraction in a micro device using silica beads and guanidine and isopropanol, those two components are PCR inhibitors. If you now contaminate the downstream PCR architecture with even nanoliter quantities of those reagents. And so the challenge was, how do you keep them divided while you're doing the independent processes, but open them up when you need to transfer the purified DNA? The last one I would point to, Chris, is how do you make this cost effective? If you can now take $100 to do a DNA fingerprinting on a sample here in the U.S., and you can now do it in an automated closed system that gets you around the chain of custody issues that you described, and make it rapid, what is somebody willing to pay for that? Are they willing to pay $400? Probably not. So how do you now do that so that it's at least the same cost as current technology, except with all of the advantages of speed and smaller volumes? And then how do you make it less expensive, ultimately what you want to do? So I think those are the challenges, both at the physical limits, but also in terms of mass production and cost to the user.
What about time to market? How far away are you from being able to unleash this, saying, here we go, we have a quality control, quality assured product that can be used for all these different applications?
That's the $64,000 question. And Zygen Microlab and Lockheed are on schedule for what will be a pre-production unit this fall. How far beyond that? I would hope no more than another year or two. So realistically, within the next 2 years, we hope to be able to have this placed in a number of labs where people are essentially testing it with their normal number of samples coming in and the normal kind of workflow that they have.
Size really is everything. That was James Landers from the University of Virginia. He's also the chief scientific officer of Zygen Microlab, the company developing that technology. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, a new device that can generate electricity by extracting energy from tiny air currents. And also, where's all the Earth's xenon gone? First, though, TB or not TB? Scientists have got a new diagnostic trick to pick up tuberculosis infection. Phil?
Yes, Chris. Well, one of the hardest things about TB is actually diagnosing the disease. According to the World Health Organization, maybe a third of the world's population is infected with tuberculosis, but only 5 to 10% of infected people ever become sick. And working out who the people carrying the disease are would be a phenomenal breakthrough for medicine. It would allow people to get treated and we could start eradicating the disease.
Indeed, something like 10,000 deaths a day and 10,000 new infections every day. I mean, it's a tremendous problem, especially in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, and a lot of them don't even know, so are passing it on to new people all the time.
So what are these guys doing?
So what Clifton Barry at the US National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease in Bethesda and Ben Davis from the University of Oxford in the UK have done is use trehalose, which is a sugar that isn't found in mammalian cells, only really in bacteria and plants, to label TB to make it easier to diagnose.
So how does it work? Talk us through the process, what they're actually doing, and how do they actually make the diagnosis?
On the surface of the tuberculosis bacteria, there are some enzymes that are involved in building up its cell wall, and they use this sugar, trehalose, to do that. So what Ben Davis's group did was to make various different modified versions of trehalose to see if they could inhibit those enzymes as potential drugs. But one of the modifications they made was to put fluorescein, a fluorescent molecule, on so that they could actually see whether it was being taken up.
Oh, I see. So the fluorescein is linked to the trehalose. So if the bacteria take up and use the sugar and incorporate it into the cell wall, they'll be incorporating fluorescein with it, so the buggers are going to glow.
Yeah, exactly. The bacteria that have taken up this trehalose sugar then glow. You can just take any sample that has the TB bacteria in it, feed them loads of the sugar. If they take the sugar up, then they glow, and you get a very easy-to-read indication of the TB there.
Sounds encouraging, and I guess pretty simple, could be used, especially in third-world countries, where TB is a real problem.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't need too much specific equipment. You just need some way of detecting the fluorescence. And what Clifton Barry says is that he's already started using the technique on patient samples in South Korea.
So we have to just watch this space and find out whether or not it turns out to be successful. Thanks, Phil. We're talking of sugary things and sweet stuff. Eleanor, a device, and you get all the best stories this month, a device that will turn waste food, drinks, whatever, into energy. This sounds like the Back to the Future. There was Mr. Fusion on the car in Back to the Future that ran on old yogurts and banana skins and things. What's this all about?
Well, this is good. Can you imagine if your iPod runs out of batteries in the future and you can just open your can of drink and charge
some
it up?
In. So yeah. Go on. How does this work then?
Scientists in China, at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing, led by Xiaojun Dong, they've made a biofuel cell that actually harvests energy from soft drinks, such as iced tea and juices.
Excuse the terrible pun, but what is the potential here? I mean, what could you do with something like this? Because, you know, outline how much energy it will produce. Presumably not very much.
Not very much, but just 1 milliliter of drink could allow the fuel cell to provide electrical energy for over a month.
Wow.
But that's for small devices.
Sure. So how does it actually work? What are the nuts and bolts in there?
OK, so you've got a bioanode and a biocathode, and these are made from carbon fibre electrodes. And these have been modified with carbon nanotubes, and they've been modified again with enzymes. So the anode, the bioanode modified with enzyme, oxidises the glucose in the soft drinks, and the biocathode reduces the oxygen in the air to water. And these two reactions then power the device.
And you could run it on anything with glucose as a source then?
Yes, well, some of the examples here, they've used iced tea, vegetable juice, fruit juice.
But where do they see this actually being applied, really? Because obviously there are devices that people have put into the human body which are powered by glucose in the bloodstream. This is externalising that and saying, well, that we could use the same thing with devices outside the body.
Yes, the teams who say that they could use it in portable power sources and implantable medical devices because they generate more power than other biofuel cell types.
I see. Do you know how far along the production line or in development this is? Is this just proof of concept or is it being taken to market soon?
Well, the team's working on improving the biocompatibility at the moment and the long-term stability of the implantable miniature biofuel cells.
So you save money on batteries but end up spending a fortune on fizzy drinks instead. But maybe there is a way to have a free lunch, after all.
My name is Zhonglin Wang. I'm a chair professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology, Atlanta, Georgia. My research in the past has been involved to harvest energy from environment to power small electronics. In the past, we spent a lot of time to develop nanotechnology, nanosensors, something small, better, high performance, lower power consumption. But when the system becomes smaller enough, the battery used to drive the system is comparably large.
So on the one hand, you're shrinking things down to the tiny scale and then completely offsetting all the benefits by having a gigantic battery attached to it, which then completely negates all the benefits of being small.
Exactly. So we want to make a small system that includes a battery. And our idea is that, can we get rid of battery that halves energy from the environment? Well, energy we have solar, mechanical, thermal, chemical. But when the device becomes small, the working environment may not have the solar energy available. Thermoelectric won't work because there's no temperature gradient. So we look at a mechanical energy, like a vibration. The voice is like you and me talk, our voice is a vibration. And for example, in a biomedical system, muscle stretching, blood flow, all this is mechanical. Can we convert this into electricity to drive these tiny devices?
And how are you doing it? What's the approach?
The approach is that we use an effect is called piezoelectric effect. This is the effect that for a certain crystal that does not have a center symmetry, when you apply a strain or force, the ions in the crystal polarizes to produce an electric field inside the crystal. Once you change the strain applied to the crystal back and forth, then you drive the electron to flow back and forth. That's the mechanism we convert mechanical deformation into electricity. And what's the efficiency? Our measurements show we can achieve 7% efficiency today. Then why nanomaterials? Because if you have a gigantic physical motion, you have a large pressure, larger force, you can do it. But we talk about living environment, something very tiny, very mild. Can you do that? So we use nanomaterials. The reason is that nanomaterials have a small dimension that can respond to this kind of mechanical triggering at a very small magnitude.
So what are you doing? Massive parallel arrays so that although an individual component will only generate a very tiny current, if you have many of them in parallel, all extracting energy from the local environment, you can add that together to produce a much bigger potential. Is that how you're doing it?
Absolutely. Let me start with the smaller materials. We call it nanowires. We use zinc oxide. It's a biocompatible environmental green material, and very cheap too. So once you have these little nanowires, you have mechanical deformation, you produce a potential. But one wire is not enough. So we develop a technology. We integrate the contribution of millions of these nanowires on a little tiny area, form an array, so that we can produce today up to 5 to 10 volts output, and the size about like a fingertip size, and a power reach microwatt and even milliwatts range. And so what that mean? Let's say if you reach to microwatts, to milliwatts, a lot of things can be driven. Let's, from the thing we're familiar with, like AirPod. In order to drive an AirPod, you need about 50 milliwatt energy drivers. Today, we already reach a couple of milliwatts. So we're not too far away from drive AirPod. But AirPod is a big, you know, it's a big unit. If we can drive this, we can drive a lot more smaller unit.
Gosh, that's amazing. So how do you actually make these arrays of these nanowires and then couple them to get the energy out?
This is the key, because we have two ways to make it. We have vapor phase. We also use chemical growth. We can grow on wafer level, use a pattern technique, arrays by simple solution chemistry at a temperature less than 100 degrees C. And you don't need a clean room to do this kind of fabrication. And the way you integrate them together is that if you have an array of nanowires, you build a bottom electrode, you have a top electrode. If all these wires work together, the electrode collects the charge from all of them.
And what's the working lifetime of the material? How long will it continue to vibrate like this? In other words, am I going to have to buy a new one of these every week to run my iPod in future, or is this going to last 10 years?
We do the test. When you make a thing small, tiny little nanowires, the mechanical robustness improves dramatically. Let's give you a number. We use the nanowires. We put in a resonance, this local vibration. We run it for 35 billion cycles to test if there's any fatigue. Our result shows this is basically fatigue-free because the small size at a nanoscale. And we can make this work many, many, many cycles. 35 billion cycles is a lot of cycles. It can run for many years.
When will people be actually seeing this technology manifest in their daily lives?
I anticipate in 5 to 7 years we'll reach some industrial application.
John Ling Wang, he works at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. And now to Earth's missing xenon, although I didn't know there was any missing, Mike.
Nor did I, Chris, but apparently we are missing xenon. And scientists have been wondering about this for many years because by theoretical calculations and studies of meteorites that have hit Earth, the abundance of all noble gases in the solar system are supposed to be about the same.
Sure, so comparing what we see in space with what we see here on Earth, we expect, because we formed out of the same sort of cosmic blob, we ought to have the same sorts of proportions, and you're saying that there is less xenon than there ought to be.
Yeah, in actual fact, there's about 20 times less xenon in the atmosphere.
So where's it gone?
This is what scientists have been trying to find out. And in 2005, there was a team of researchers that discovered that xenon, at high temperatures and pressures, can displace silicon in quartz. So it can actually swap with the silicon and bind to the two oxygen atoms to make xenon dioxide.
That's a bit unusual because it's a noble gas.
Yeah, that's right. So it's supposed to be inert, but they found at these extreme pressures and temperatures that this possibly could happen.
Would this be deep in sort of mantle or, you know, deep crust this is supposed to be happening?
Yeah, in the Earth's crust. Yeah.
Okay, and that is drawing it down from the atmosphere, thus accounting for the fact that there's less than there should be because it's all in the quartz.
Yeah, so the hypothesis was that this could account for the loss of atmospheric xenon and therefore, you know, what we see today, 20 times less. So what they hypothesised was that when the Earth was being bombarded with high amounts of meteorites, which are rich in quartz, that was at the stage when the xenon was actually locked into the quartz and displaced the silicon. And so therefore it's under the ground that we walk on. So now David Brock and colleagues at McMaster University in Ontario have actually put weight to this. They've done a lab experiment where they've taken xenon tetrafluoride and they've reacted it with water at very low temperatures. And they found that they've created xenon dioxide.
Exactly what you were saying that ought to be in quartz.
Yes.
If this exists.
Yes. So they've reacted it. They haven't reacted it with quartz, but they've reacted it with water at extreme temperatures. And they found that this yellow-orange solid is produced.
Thus demonstrating that it is possible to get this very thing which is intrinsic to the mechanism of where the xenon would have gone.
Yeah, that's right. So this has implications for geochemists because they use the abundance of noble gases because they're supposed to be inert to predict timings and processes of major processes in terrestrial processes such as the atmosphere forming and things like that. So what it's basically saying is that a noble gas that is actually supposed to be inert, if it's not so inert, then maybe their timings are off.
Oh dear, that could have quite serious consequences then, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Are there any other explanations? Because obviously it's a long way to go from reacting this thing under laboratory conditions, okay, it's an extreme of temperature, but to that then happen in the wild for real.
I think it adds further weight to the hypothesis. I mean, I think we're a little way off from actually saying, confirming for sure that this is the case, but it does kind of add weight to this hypothesis.
Thank you, Mike. Well, something else pretty weighty, something stodgy. And apparently you can thicken up a runny liquid by paradoxically actually adding fluid to it, Phil.
Yes, Chris, sounds weird, doesn't it? What Aaron Kuss and Norbert Willenbacher at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in Germany have found is exactly that. If you take a suspension of solid particles in a liquid and add another liquid that doesn't mix with the solvent that you're originally in, then it sticks all of the particles together and thickens up the liquid into a gel.
OK, well, if we take something like corn flour or custard, so some kind of starch floating around in the water, How would this apply to that then?
Okay, so well, the equivalent would be you've got your solid starch particles, they're surrounded by water. So if you added something like oil doesn't mix with the water, but it might be attracted to the surface of the starch particles. And then all of those bits of oil want to sort of get together by the sort of hydrophobic effect and all of that kind of thing. So they stick and form bridges between the particles, which makes a kind of gel matrix. The researchers didn't actually use custard because they had to do something a little bit more controlled. So they used glass particles. They've got two kinds of glass particles, some that are water-loving, they're hydrophilic, and some that are hydrophobic. They took the hydrophilic particles, suspended them in oil, and then added a tiny bit of water. The water coats the glass hydrophilic particles because it's attracted to the hydrophilic surface.
Cross-links them all together,
and you get a thick sort of custardy gel as you add a little bit more water.
And then they flip this round with the other particles. You do the reverse experiment. So you take the hydrophobic glass, little bit of oil, then add water, presumably, and do the reverse.
Yes, so suspend the hydrophobic particles in the water, add a little bit of oil, and it goes from a sort of runny liquid. You keep stirring, add a little bit more oil, a couple more drops more oil, and you get this kind of thick, custardy, mouldable gel.
Sounds very interesting from an academic point of view, but are there any practical points to this?
Yeah, well, one of the things that the research team is suggesting is that you could use it in designing functional or healthier foods. If you want to replace some of the fat in food, then you could do it by encapsulating it in water, and then you can maintain the structure of the food without having the fat there. Or you could replace things like the emulsifiers and surfactants that are put into various products that maybe we wouldn't want to put in there.
Well, cynics may argue that supermarkets already replace the food in the food with various tricks that make it buy more water. Can't say we want to go down that line. But, so you're saying that basically you'd have a way of having food which had more apparent consistency with actually less in it.
If you think about wanting to diet, you still want to eat the same amount of food and feel full. So you want food that will fill your stomach, but not necessarily have the same calorific or fat content. So you get the same kind of fullness and pleasure from eating it, but without the pain on the other side of the diet.
Far be it from me to suggest that supermarkets would ever consider selling you food artificially inflated with thickening agents. Nutritious slimming milkshake, anybody? Well, that's almost it for this month, but before we go, what have you got in the chemistry trivia trough for us, Phil?
Well, one of the problems that we've heard quite a lot about in recent years is farmers applying a little bit too much fertiliser to their fields to try and get the crops to grow, to try and maximise their yields. But some of that fertiliser ends up running off into waterways. You've got problems with nitrogen because it makes algae bloom in the rivers and that can kill the fish. But another problem is phosphorus. And according to the United Nations Environment Programme, around 22 million tonnes of phosphorus flows off our land into the marine environment every year, which is a massive amount, especially considering that our reserves of phosphorus are not particularly high. It's an element that we're running out of.
What do they say we should do about it? Tell farmers, put less on your fields? Or what do they say the solution is?
One of the things that we can do is try and apply fertiliser a bit more sensibly and only use the minimum amount to get the appropriate yield so that as little as possible runs off the field. The other thing that we can do is try and find alternative sources of phosphorus. So one of the biggest sources of phosphorus is actually urine. Thames Water, in fact, have a programme where they take the mineral struvite, which is what you call calcium phosphate when it's deposited in waste water pipes, strip that out and turn it back into fertiliser to be spread back on the fields in a true recycling.
Not sure how you get the hard stuff out of the pipes in the first place, though. Maybe that's the subject for next time. Well, that's it for this month. Thank you to our contributors, Phil Broadwith, Mike Brown and Eleanor Richards, and our guests, James Landers and Jean-Ling Wang. The production this month was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. We'll be back reacting to more of your chemical requirements at the same time next month, but until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.